Welcome, everyone. Melinda Zarate with Emboldened Heart here. This is the first time I have done a Friday energy of call in some time. And it seemed like it was the right thing to do today. And I will tell you that I was inspired to do this particular call by a number of things. One of them was something that I saw last night watching Rachel Maddow. And I'm not watching much news right now. I can't. I just can't. It's just too difficult. It gets me, it just gets me into just too strange of a place. You know, there's just too much emotional reactivity to what I am hearing in the news right now. But Rachel Maddow is a journalist and a newscaster that I respect and I trust, and I think she has good judgment. I don't think she's perfect because she's human and none of us are, but I have great respect for her and her intelligence and her insights and her ability to communicate and also her authenticity, even her humor. She's very real and very dedicated to her work. And I watch her about once a week. I will watch for a little while. But last night, I turned it on and I watched most of her show. And it was extremely enlightening and interesting. She had done a lot of research, as usual. And I learned some things that I think I had heard most of before. But when she connected all the dots and put it all in a context, that it was just a stunning in its entirety for me. And I'm still kind of thinking about it and digesting it. Essentially, the first half of her show, she talked about how Putin rose to power after the fall of communism and the fall of the Berlin Wall, and when communism essentially disintegrated for a period of time as we knew it. And then Russian leaders came in, the first democratically elected Russian leader essentially turned over the reins to Putin, who was the second in command. And Putin was a very, very wily and opportunistic. And Putin actually began to dismantle the Russian democracy for his own gain. And one of the major things that he did was, and I remember some of this being in the news and you know, kind of reading about it and thinking, wow, that's really this is amazing. One of the first major things that Putin did to reposition himself, and for those of you that don't know this right now, Putin is the richest man in the world, and that has just recently become much more evident, and it has to do with some digging into his holdings and his net worth as a result of the Russian hacking scandal, hacking into the Democratic and Republican National Committee's email accounts and files. So, Putin is the richest man in the entire world right now. And I believe he's also one of the most dangerous. So, this is a situation where there is really a lot for us to be aware of and to take take seriously, very seriously, in fact. So, as Putin rose to power after he was essentially handed the reins by his predecessor, one of the first things he did was he identified a dissident billionaire in Russia who was really trying to interrupt his rise to power. And this was the man who founded the Yukos Oil Company in Russia, very large, very successful oil company. And the founder was really intelligent and rather open-minded man who was openly outspoken against Putin. So that was happening at the time that Putin was kind of moving into a much stronger position. And so what happened was the founder of Yukos was jailed by Putin. He was jailed, and his name was Khodorkovsky. He was really an advocate for democratization and international cooperation and Russian reform. Well, and at that point, this was in 2003, Khodorkovsky, the founder of Yukos, was the richest man in Russia and the 16th richest man in the world at the time. Well, he was arrested by Putin, and Yukos, the company, was forcibly broken up for alleged unpaid taxes. Who knows whether or not there really were unpaid taxes, but that's the story. That's the storyline. So Putin then seized Yukos and took its assets for the government. And so the Russian government then continued to present Yukos with a series of these tax claims, froze all the assets of Yukos, and the company was unable to pay these outrageous tax demands. So the Yukos assets were taken by Putin and transferred for a fraction of the value to state-owned oil companies, one of which was and still is owned by Putin's second in command. They call him his shadow. And it was this billion-dollar company was sold to Putin's buddy for like something like $29. So that effectively eliminated the competition for Putin. And that worked so well that he continued to do the same sort of thing with other dissidents and with other companies and organizations. And he has continued to do that same sort of thing to this very day and has enriched himself personally to the point where he is the richest man on earth. Now, I don't think anybody listening really would consider Putin to be a nice guy or, you know, someone that we can trust or, you know, enter into any kind of genuinely positive collaboration with. His end game really is to control the world, I think. And again, that's my opinion. But there's plenty of evidence that indicates that that's his end game. So we now have a situation where our newly elected, and I say that in quotations because he wasn't elected popularly, but our new leader appears to be in bed with Putin, at least to some extent. It will, you know, hopefully we'll learn more and know more, but who knows? So there has been this enormous sea change of of what is going on internationally and politically that we are now looking at. It's all over the news. Whether there will be any really dramatic legal or political action taken remains to be seen. We'll just have to see. But all of this really, really got me thinking, what can we do? What can those of us do who care? Those of us who do have a heart, those of us who do want to see the values that this country was founded on, and, you know, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness for all. Those of us who want to see that sort of thing continue, or at least be valued and honored again. What can we do? What can little old me do? What can you do? Well, I think there are some things that we can do. Actually, there are quite a few things that we can do. So, those of you who've listened to me before know that I am an absolute raving fan of the work done by Dr. David R. Hawkins, Power Versus Force. And I just continue to think that this is one of the most important books that has been written in this century, actually in the last 100 years. It's just so profound and so well written, and it contains so much important information. So I am going to take this power versus force construct and apply it to what is going on right now in our outer world and what we can do within ourselves to make a difference. So for those of you who are not familiar with it, the title of the book is Power Versus Force, The Hidden Determinants of Human Behavior by Dr. David R. Hawkins, MD, PhD. And this book was, I believe, originally written, I believe it was written in 1995. Yes, 1995 was when it was originally published. So Dr. Hawkins was a researcher and a psychologist, a medical doctor, who had done a great deal of work with mental patients, and had done a lot of really interesting research. And he began to work with more and more of the general population in his research using kinesiology, muscle testing, which has been around now for 40 years, to really do some research to determine whether consciousness could be determined and whether there was any kind of consistency. For comprehensive analysis of the emotional and spiritual development of individuals, societies, and the human race in general. Extremely interesting. And he did this work. There were over 20 years of this work where he developed a method of calibrating and checking an individual to determine the calibration score of different concepts, different states of mind, emotions, states of consciousness, you know, ideas, all kinds of things. And it was absolutely consistent throughout the population. And he worked with people over the age of 18. I don't think there was any top age, but they had to be over the age of 18 and of, quote, sound mind. And he worked with men and women, worked with people from all cultures, all economic strata. Just, it was a very wide swath of the population. And in doing this, he created a calibration scale between 1 and 1,000. 1 being death, you know, no life, no consciousness, no nothing, no life, zero, dead. All the way up to 1,000, which is completely enlightened being, avatar kind of thing, and everything in between. And as he began to work with these people, it really became completely obvious that humanity, every human being, all humans, have a moral code within them. And Dr. Hawkins actually created what he calls a map of consciousness. And it is so fascinating. And he calibrated different emotions and different states of mind at different things. Again, same calibration over and over and over, no matter whether it was man or woman, what country they were from, you know, what language they spoke, what their economic or educational level was, same calibration. So, again, death was zero, no life. The next one up is shame, calibrated at 20, guilt at 30, apathy, which is uncaring, at 50, grief at 75, and a lot of us have been feeling a lot of grief here lately about the state of our country and the state of the world at large, and so we've been calibrating pretty low if we're in the stages of grief. And there are 5 stages of grief. We talked about that the other day. Fear calibrates at 100. Have we been operating out of some fear lately? Wow, hugely. The fear level has been massive, and it continues to be. And fear is a pretty low calibration on the scale. It's just 10% into the map of consciousness and awareness and enlightenment. So probably the majority of the populace has been operating out of fear, low calibration. Desire calibrates at 125, and I think maybe desire was what fueled some of the decision making as far as the recent vote in the United States election. Desire again, 125. It really isn't a very evolved consciousness level. It has to do with denying, disappointment, craving, and enslavement. That all has to do with desire. Not very pretty, right? The next level up is anger at 150, and that has to do with vengefulness, antagonistic thinking, aggression, and even hate. And there's been a lot of that flying around too, hasn't there? Lots of anger, hate, aggression, antagonism. It was just the theme of the election at large. But certainly the theme of the man who is now going to step into the reins as president of the United States. Yikes. Then as we move up the scale of consciousness, pride is 175, still, you know, pretty low on the scale. And the pride has to do with kind of indifference and demanding, scorn, inflation of ego. Again, not real pretty, and there's some of that showing up in a big way right now, and we're just kind of watching it with concern is certainly the way I'm watching it. So all of those emotions that I just mentioned fall below 200. Below 200. So again, that's just 20% up the scale of consciousness. And all of those emotions below 200, what Dr. Hawkins realized, have to do with force. They all have to do with force. Okay? Above 200, things change. 200 is when courage shows up, as our consciousness is raised and we mature and evolve in our understanding. Courage shows up and calibrates at 200. And that is when we move from force into power. Courage has to do with affirming, permitting, seeing things as being feasible, reasonable, with personal empowerment. Courage. That is where authentic power kicks in. And then as we move up the scale from 200 courage to neutrality, which has to do with trust, and neutrality calibrates at 250, and then willingness has to do with optimism, intention, inspiration, calibrates at 310, acceptance calibrates at 350, and acceptance has to do with understanding, forgiveness. It's more harmonious. It has to do with mercy, acceptance. The next one up the scale is reason. This has to do with meaning, also understanding, but on more of a mental level. It has to do with abstraction and, again, reason calibrates at 400. Moving up the scale to 500 is love. Love has to do with reverence, respect, gratitude, appreciation, revelation. It's benign, it's loving, and again, calibrates at 500. And this is just halfway up the scale. Joy calibrates at 540, peace calibrates at 600, enlightenment shows up at 700 and above. And that is ineffable. It's pure consciousness, enlightenment. So that is the framework for power versus force. But now let's actually get into a little bit of more of an understanding of it. One of the things that we really can clearly, I think, begin to understand is that power arises from meaning. It has to do with principle. It has to do with that which supports the significance of life itself. It appeals to that part of human nature that we call noble, in contrast to force, which really appeals to that which we call crass and less developed. Power appeals to what uplifts and dignifies and ennobles and emboldens us. Force always has to be justified. Power requires no justification. It just is. Force is associated with the partial, power with the whole. Force always moves against something. Power doesn't move against anything at all. And this is so important. Force is incomplete and therefore has to be fed energy constantly. Whereas power is total and complete in itself, and it requires nothing from the outside. Because force has an insatiable appetite, it constantly consumes. Think Putin. Think Exxon Mobil. power, in contrast, energizes. It gives forth, it supplies, and supports. Power gives life and energy. Force takes these away. Power is associated with compassion, and it makes us feel positively about ourselves and life. Force is associated with judgment, limits, lack, and it makes us feel poorly about ourselves. Force always creates counterforce. Its effect is to polarize rather than to unify. And wow, have we been watching polarization? Oh my gosh, it's just incredible. And because force incites polarization, it inevitably produces a win-lose dichotomy. Somebody always loses, enemies are created, somebody always wins. And constantly faced with enemies, force requires constant defense. Defensiveness is invariably costly, whether personally, whether in the marketplace, politics, or in international affairs. So in looking for the source of power, note that it is associated with meaning, and this meaning has to do with the significance of life itself. The sources of power are inarguable. They're not subject to proof. They are self-evident. Life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness have to do with power. So all of these things are incredibly important for us to keep in mind. And every civilization is characterized by native principles. If the principles of a civilization are noble, it succeeds. If they're selfish, it fails. We can look all throughout history and see this. And we, now, certainly in the United States, or as I saw on the cover of Time magazine last week, the divided states of America, as to be led by Trump. As a term, principles may sound abstract, but the consequences are very concrete. And if we examine principles, we see that they reside in an invisible realm within consciousness itself. I mean, we can certainly point out examples of honesty in the world, honesty itself as an organizing principle to civilization. True power emanates from consciousness itself, what we see as a visible manifestation of the invisible. So that's where we are standing right now, listeners. We are standing on a precipice where we can decide which way we individually want to go. And there's a really important reason for us on an individual level to make this decision and set this intention and begin to move in this direction. And I'm going to explain why that is. So I'm going to continue, and much of this information I'm sharing is coming right straight out of the book, Power versus Force, and a lot of it is verbatim because I can't say it any better than Dr. Hawkins said it. So, there is an entire chapter in this book called Power in Politics. How about that? And this book was, you know, again, it was written in 1995, ahead of its time, but I'm so grateful that this book and this information is available to us. So, power in politics. So, to better understand the difference between force and power and the implications of this distinction in our own lives, it's helpful to examine human endeavor on a larger scale, and the interactions of men and governments provide many very clear examples for us. I mean, we can look throughout history all the way back to, you know, ancient times and see examples of power in politics that worked out really well and many that were, wow, what a tragic picture and what a disaster. I mean, think of Nero fiddling while Rome burned. So, and that's just one of them. But again, just kind of looking back into recent history, one of the most powerful examples and pivotal events came about in this past century through the power of a solitary man, Mahatma Gandhi, a 90-pound, quote, colored, unquote, who single-handedly overcame the British Empire, which then was the greatest force in the world and ruled two-thirds of the face of the globe at the time. Not only did Gandhi bring the British Empire to its knees, he brought down the curtain on centuries-old drama of colonialism. And he did it by simply standing for a principle, the intrinsic dignity of man and his right to freedom, sovereignty, and self-determination. And he did this with no violence. Gandhi believed that human rights are not granted by any earthly power or person, but they are ingrained in the nature of man himself because they're inherent in his creation. That was Gandhi's principle. And violence is force, but since Gandhi was aligned with power instead of force, he forbade all use of violence in his cause. And because he expressed these universal principles, which calibrate at 700, Gandhi calibrated at 700, he was able to unite the will of the people. And at that point, he became unconquerable. And colonialism, interestingly, calibrates at 175. Below power, and Gandhi demonstrated for the whole world to witness the power of selflessness versus the force of self-interest. And the same principle was also demonstrated beautifully in South Africa by Nelson Mandela. It was also demonstrated in the United States of America by Abraham Lincoln. Power accomplishes with ease what force, even with extreme effort, cannot accomplish. And even in our own time, most of you listening will remember this, or you certainly know about it. We saw what looked to be an almost effortless toppling of communism in Russia as a governmental form. The Berlin Wall came down. After half a century of really the most ominous and ultimately ineffectual military confrontation in history, and unfortunately, and I think this is still true today, unfortunately, the political naivete of the Russian people, who were long used to the tyrannical rule of czars, which didn't really allow them the civic wisdom to understand that a totalitarian dictatorship was being established in the name of communism. And unfortunately, I mean, they had a respite from that for a brief period of time. But Putin has come in and is a tyrannical czar. So they're kind of back to the drawing board, unfortunately. And unfortunately, the rest of the world is really now at risk. Similarly, the German people were deceived by Hitler, who rose to power in the name of National Socialism, only to establish a virtual tyranny. And it's important to realize that a distinctive characteristic of force in politics is that it cannot tolerate dissent. So just think about the recent political campaign in the United States and the inability to tolerate dissent. Really, really interesting. So, Adolf Hitler assembled the greatest military machine the world had ever seen. On the simple just level of force, his military was unbeatable. Yet, he couldn't defeat a tiny island across the English Channel because of the power expressed by Winston Churchill, who unified the will of his people through the principles of freedom and selfless sacrifice. Churchill stood for power, Hitler for force. And when the two meet, power always eventually succeeds in the long run, if it is deeply founded in the will and the consciousness of the people. In that case, power is immune to force. So I'm going to repeat that. Power always eventually succeeds if it is deeply founded in the will and the consciousness of the people. Okay? It's the point being made that we have to become sovereign in our own individual consciousness and choose power. Force is seductive. It emanates a certain glamour, and whether that glamour is manifested in the guise of false patriotism or prestige or dominance or, you know, blustering rhetoric. Conversely, true power is, you know, it's quite unglamorous. There's not lots of lights and camera and action and, you know, fluff and pomp and circumstance around true power. And, you know, when Hitler was really in his traces, it looked pretty glamorous, I guess. The Gestapo and the Luftwaffe during World War II, they were elite branches embodying romance and privilege and style, and they had enormous force at their disposal, including the most advanced weapons of the day and an esprit de corps that cemented their might. Such is the glamour of the formidable. And unfortunately, the weak, i.e. those who are susceptible to force, they're attracted to it, and they'll even die for it, the glamour of force. Otherwise, how could something as outrageous and insane as war occur? Force seizes the upper hand temporarily, and the weak, those who are not as standing in their own power, they're attracted by those who seem to have overcome weakness, i.e. Trump, the great savior. The great savior for the United States. He's going to make it great again. That's all I'm going to say on that. So how else could dictatorship be possible if there weren't weak people who were attracted by someone who seemed to have overcome weakness? This is a very key point. One characteristic of force is arrogance. Power is characterized by humility. And I'm sorry, I just have to say this. Arrogance equals Trump. Humility equals Obama. Obama has been very humble, and a lot of people have felt that he's been weak. He has not. However, he has not been respected. He has not been supported. He has been undermined with a lot of force. Force is pompous. it has all the answers, or so it presents. Power is unassuming. And the truth is that many political systems and social movements begin with true power, authentic power. But as time goes on, they become co-opted by self-seekers, and they end up relying increasingly on force until they finally fall in disgrace. And I hope that is not what has happened with the United States. I hope and pray that is not going to be the outcome. So just to kind of fully comprehend this dichotomy that we're discussing here, it's necessary to consider the difference between politicians and statesmen. Politicians operate out of expediency. They rule by force after gaining their position through the force of persuasion, often through dishonesty, lack of ethics, rhetoric, and they calibrate at a level less than 200. However, statesmen represent true power. They are ruled by inspiration. They teach by example. They stand for self-evident principle. Statesmen invoke the nobility that resides within all of us and unifies us. Statesmen live in what can best be termed their heart. Although the intellect is easily fooled, the heart recognizes the truth. The intellect is limited. The heart is unlimited. The intellect is intrigued by the temporary and fleeting, and the heart is only concerned with the permanent and true. Again, force relies on rhetoric, propaganda, specious arguments to garner support and disguise underlying motivations. And we have certainly witnessed plenty of that recently, all over our television and news feeds. One characteristic of truth is that it needs no defense. It's self-evident that all men are created equal, requires no justification or rhetorical persuasion. That it's wrong to gas people to death in concentration camps is self-evident. It requires no argument. The principles that true power is based upon never require any kind of vindication or explanation. Force inevitably does. There's always an endless argument about it, about whether force is justified or not, why it's necessary. So at this point, it should be clear that power is associated with that which supports life, and force is associated with that which exploits life for the gain of an individual or an organization. Force is divisive and it polarizes. Power attracts. Force repels. Power serves others. Force is self-serving. Power appeals to our higher nature. Force to our lower self. Force is limited. Power is unlimited. Through its insistence that the ends justify the means, force sells out freedom for expediency. Force offers quick, easy solutions. Let me make America great again. In power, the means and the end are the same. but ends require greater maturity, discipline, understanding, and patience to be brought to fruition. Great leaders inspire us to have faith, trust, and confidence because of the power of their absolute integrity and alignment with inviolate principles. Such figures understand that you cannot compromise principles and still retain your power. So, this is so important. This is about life as we know it. And more importantly, this is about life as we wish, want, intend, and claim to experience it. So the more people that get on board and really begin to understand this, think, move, and act on it, the quicker we will see the change. So, some important things to remember. Again, since we're talking about what can we do individually that will make a difference, this is what Dr. Hawkins found through his many, many, many thousands of calibration tests in his research, that only 15% of the world's population is above the critical consciousness level of 200. And this was, again, this was about 27 years ago that this was published. What he said was that the collective power of that 15% has the weight to counterbalance the negativity of the remaining 85% of the world's people. Again, I'm going to repeat that. It's so important. Even though only 15, maybe say 20% now, let's be optimistic. Let's say 20% of the world's population is above the critical consciousness level of 200. 80% is still below. The collective power of that small percent, the 20%, has the weight to counterbalance the negativity of the remaining 80 to 85% of the world's population. Because the scale of power advances logarithmically. And because of that, a single person, an avatar, if you will, at a consciousness level of 1,000 could counterbalance the collective negativity of all mankind. And at the time that Dr. Hawkins did this work, there were 12 people on the planet who calibrated at 700. Be interesting to find out how many are on the planet right now. But nonetheless, let's carry on. What Dr. Hawkins found is that one individual who calibrates at 300 counterbalances 90,000 individuals below level 200. One person at 300. So what can you do? You can raise yourself to 300, which is willingness, intention, inspiring, hopeful, optimism. Raise yourself to that level and counterbalance 90,000. If you can pull yourself up to the level of reason, which is 400, which has to do with understanding, meaning, wisdom, abstraction, one person at the level of 400 counterbalances 400,000 individuals below level 200. How about that? I think that's worth going for. I totally think that's worth going for. Why not? You know, all of us come here and wonder what we're here to do. Here it is. This is it. This is what we're here to do. We are here to raise our own consciousness and our own sovereignty through self-love, self-respect, to bring up those who are not there. So it gets even better. It gets even better. One individual at 500, which is the level of love, is benign, has to do with reverence, respect for life, is benign. One person at the level of love counterbalances 750,000 individuals below 200. Okay, why not? Let's go for it. One person who calibrates at 600, which is peace. And peace has to do with bliss, illumination, clarity, seeing. One person at 600 counterbalances, get this, 10 million individuals that are below level 200. One person at 600. So I will invite all of you to aspire to raise your level of consciousness to 600, which is, you know, that's a tall order. I understand. But let's at least get ourselves up to the point where we're really making an impact. Let's get ourselves up above 400, up above 500 if we can. Let's change the consciousness of a massive number of people. And what Dr. Hawkins really determined was that were it not for these counterbalances, mankind would have self-destructed just out of the sheer mass of its unopposed negativity. That's not very encouraging, but thank heaven that's not the case. That is not the case. And there have been many instances throughout history where we see examples of this. I mean, during the Holocaust, people who helped other people escape, people who really risked their lives to ensure safety for children on the trains, to help people who would have ended up in the gas chambers to get to a safe place. After 9/11, the outpouring of love from the entire planet for the United States, for those who had lost their loved ones. There are many, many examples throughout history where it is obvious that a smaller number of people changed the course of things, changed history. And I can't help but think of the beautiful quote by Margaret Mead, never doubt that a dedicated group of individuals can change the course of history. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has. Never doubt that a small group of concerned citizens can change the course of history. So let's be those citizens. What else is there to do? What better thing do we have to do? I mean, this is how I'm feeling. This is what I'm thinking. This is where we are at, folks. It's time. Again, there is no more need to ask, what's my purpose? What's my mission? Why am I here? Here it is. So, carrying on. So the last beautiful chapter in the book, Power Versus Force, has to do with resolution. How do we resolve this? How do we resolve this? And again, I'll remind you that from the analysis that Dr. Hawkins did, again, over and over and over, he was able to really document and determine and prove over and over that there is a difference in power between a loving thought and a fearful thought. And it's the difference is so enormous as to be beyond the capacity of the human imagination to really comprehend easily. So even a few loving thoughts throughout the course of the day more than counterbalance all of our negative thoughts. So, again, how can we contribute? How can we help to resolve this tilt that it appears we are in? Well, since the progression of consciousness during the average human lifetime on Earth, according to the work that Dr. Hawkins did, the progression of consciousness during the average human lifetime on this Earth is only 5 points. But this is enormous in individual awareness. And those of us who deliberately and intentionally and purposefully choose over and over to raise our consciousness, theoretical physics and nonlinear dynamics have shown that any individual increase also raises the consciousness of everyone on the planet to some degree. So, to become more conscious is the greatest gift that any one of us can give to the world. But, in a beautiful ripple effect, it comes back to its source. And what Dr. Hawkins also learned was that at points in time where mankind stood at a perilous level, that it can subtly jump to an unusually high level. So let's take that as our cause right now. In a social framework, you know, we can certainly choose to refuse passive submission to any political system that falls below the level of 200. And we can apply our newly developed faculties of examination and correction to it. It's really, you know, it's now possible, for instance, unfortunately, it was not employed during this last election, but it's possible to establish clear criteria for selecting holders of public office. And maybe each office should require a specific minimum level of awareness in order to be effective. In general, maybe any government official who calibrates below 200 can't solve problems. Instead, they'll create problems. That's maybe what we've got right now. So we have to do something. We have to do something to change this picture. We absolutely have to do something. And it's kind of sort of chic in many intellectual circles to be really negative and to, you know, to judge and complain and put things down. And, you know, it's cool. It's cool to be negative. It's cool to be pessimistic. It's cool to focus more on the dark side of mankind's behavior. Well, I think that is a huge waste of humanity. It's a huge waste of energy, thought power, behavior, and intention, focus. Huge waste. So I would challenge any and all of you who tend to kind of go that direction in autopilot. And we all have that propensity at times. I mean, oh gosh, I can rant and rave around and really get going, you know, when I let my head, my hamster wheel mind go. But let's try and get out of that. Let's try and let our hearts take the lead. Embolden our hearts. Allow them to lead and our brain to get in sync with our heart, behind our heart, or next to our heart. Because our heart is what will help us to stay focused. To stay focused on those beautiful, enduring concepts and principles of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. So I want to thank all of you for listening. I'm on my soapbox. I know it. I'm going to stay here for a while. I want a lot of people to get up here with me. Get up on this soapbox. I need you. We all need you. We've got a really, really important assignment here. It's huge. It is huge. We're being called. Let's heed the call. The emboldened heart call. Please join me. Thank you so much for being here and listening. If this resonates with you, pass it on. Share it. This link is going to stay up indefinitely. Put it on your social media. Email your friends. Email those that you care about and love. Let's all get on board. It's not out of our hands at all as individuals to really step in here and really make a difference. So thank you, and bless you all with all good things. Namaste. Bye-bye for now.